Thus Strikes the Black Pimpernel, the 15th story in The Obama Inheritance, 15 Stories of Conspiracy Noir from Three Rooms Press by Gary Phillips. President Trump once again blamed former President Obama for leaks of classified information from the White House and for the continued vociferous protests against his administration. This in the wake of several of Trump's controversial executive orders and policies, such as when he halted immigration from 7, then 6, predominantly Muslim countries to the U.S. Trump, over time, had doubled down on these comments in interviews with like-minded news outlets, during which he provided no evidence for his claims, including that British intelligence had a hand in the surveillance. "I think he's behind it," Trump said. "I also think it's just politics. That's just the way it is," he continued. "You never know what's exactly happening behind the scenes. I think that President Obama's behind it because his people are certainly behind it." He added, "Some of the leaks possibly come from that group. You know, some of the leaks, which are really very serious leaks because they're very bad in terms of national security. But I also understand that's politics and it will probably continue." The man occupying one of the most powerful positions in the world reemphasized that Obama had engineered the bugging of the phones in Trump Tower prior to the presidential election. "Terrible. Just found out that Obama had my wires tapped in Trump Tower just before the victory. Nothing found. This is McCarthyism," Trump had tweeted one morning in the early days of his administration. Texas Agricultural Commissioner Joaquin Norcross, who most likely will be running for the Dems' nod to challenge Trump, recently spoke on this matter in an interview conducted with the National Atlantic magazine. "Let's be clear, these ongoing fantasies of the president demonstrate how out of touch he is. He hasn't delivered on his campaign promises, notably attention to and repairing our infrastructure, let alone bringing jobs back in coal or steel. It's his patented tactic. When things go wrong, he looks for others to blame, when in fact, the buck stops with him. Plain and simple." At State Smasher, "That fool Norcross ain't nothing but a grand pocho. Hashtag sellout pocho." At Roll On, "He's more legit than your mama. You trifling like the brothers and sisters say. Hashtag trifling nig." At State Smasher, "That's not what your mama said last night, bitch ass. He need that big heart on like I give her. Only a magna minima. Hashtag bitch ass punk." The cab of the self-driving truck had been retrofitted with nearly $50,000 worth of hardware and software. The 18-wheeler Kenworth was cruising comfortably down the highway at 55 miles per hour. Bill Collier, the human occupant in the passenger seat, technically the overseer of this test drive and a seasoned freight hauler, had many miles ago gotten bored with the amazed stares and gapes from other drivers. This since leaving the plant in Fort Collins with 50,000 cans of beer in the trailer. His destination was a warehouse some 11 hours away in Nevada. Plenty of gawkers had taken photos with their smartphones of the empty driver's seat as the truck rumbled along. The vehicle was an automatic, as a tech that could handle shifting the dual clutch action of a big rig was, for the foreseeable future, non-existent. But that was little comfort to the men and women Collier bent elbows with in taverns across this nation. Like global warming, no matter how hard some might deny its existence, the era of the autonomous truck was coming and jobs would be lost. Or rather, the idea seemed to be that the trucks would travel the highways where a jaywalking pedestrian or a kid running into the street to fetch her ball was less likely, and therefore a sudden swerve or braking was not as much a factor. As they neared the city, the trucks would pull into a designated facility, and the human would climb aboard to drive it into the city, handling trickier maneuvers. But what sort of wage would that be compared to truckers getting paid by the mile or the hour? Kyra was making another notation on his touchscreen iPad in his log for the engineers at Globestar, the Silicon Valley firm that had outfitted the truck. He felt a disturbance in his seat as the cab shook. He glanced up and saw that a family van had suddenly stopped less than half the length of a football field in front of him, despite the roadway being clear. Worse, it was cocked sideways, and this was a two-lane section of the highway leading to a rise. Acting fast but calmly, as the sensors applied the air brakes and the rear tires of the trailer smoked, Collier pressed his palm on a large red button on the side console that would disengage the computers and return manual control to him. Akin to twin steering wheels in a driver's ed car, the wheel on his side of the cab dropped down into place as he got his hands on it. At that exact moment, zooming over the small hill outside the Kenworth's windshield, coming along in the opposite direction, was a low-slung sports model ragtop Mercedes. A man and woman were in it, arguing, their mouths wide open, each gesticulating severely, their machine traveling at least 100 miles an hour. The man was driving but was glaring at the woman, who was now giving him the finger. That way blocked, Collier had no choice but to twist the wheel to his right and take the 18-wheeler off the highway, lest he crash into both cars. This took him across a span of gravel alongside a roadside cafe called the Duck Blind, though this was on the edge of the desert along I-515. Several cars were parked on the gravel, and there was no space big enough between any of them to drive through unscathed. The truck's terminus was to have been in Henderson, but now it would have to be here as Collier fought for control of the truck, the rear trailer swinging to and fro as the tire sought purchase as gravel spewed from beneath the threads. Shit, Collier cursed, bringing the rig to a shuddering stop and shutting off the motor. He got out of the passenger side, the brakes hissing compressed air as the truck settled. Everything considered, he'd only clipped two cars and ruined a third. It was a black Lincoln, and the front of the cab had been crushed between the right front fender and a cinder block building behind the restaurant, a separate toilet facility. Collier saw as he got out his phone. Others were already out of the Duck Blind, taking their own snaps or heading toward him, no doubt the pissed off owners of the vehicles he'd hit. What the hell, Holmes? A 20-something Chicano in a Rams cap said as he walked over to Collier. Among the small crowd of customers and staff ebbing out onto the lot were two middle-aged white men. One was in a sport coat and slacks, open collar, and his companion in short sleeves and rimless, owlish glasses. The stern-faced men exchanged low words to one another, and both got into a late-model Lexus and left the scene. The man of many faces was at his most centered when engaged in his daily regime of exercises, in his hidden lair beneath the Civil War-era Greenbrier Cemetery in a rugged part of town. The hipsters would not be opening an artisanal grilled cheese sandwich shop in anytime soon, no matter the cheap rents. The entrance to his sanctum sanctorum, as it were, was via a secret entrance in a crumbling marble vault. The identification etched over its green patina doors in marble read the Obler family. In his exercise area, past the computer console, where he accessed the computers of the NSA and the Military Intelligence Agency through back doors created for him by a talented but quite paranoid hacker named Frag Lawson, the People's Outlaw was finishing up as the sun rose over the broken and leaning headstones in the cemetery above him. He was doing another set on the salmon ladder. This was a device where you started out as if doing a pull-up. The bar you grabbed overhead was not fixed to his rungs, and, utilizing upper body strength, you leaped up while holding the bar to the next higher dual rungs and so on until you reached the top. His routine also included isolating certain muscle groups, as well as overall development of motor, control, and power, which meant a combination of free weights, weight training, yoga for flexibility and mobility, and a series of exercises in stealth and paralyzing hand strikes said to have been perfected by the mythical ninja Sarutobi Suzuki. Twice a week, he altered this part of his workout with weapons practice, including kasurai gama, chain and scythe, the bow staff, and of course, nunchucks. There were also a set of wooden dummies with protruding arms and legs to practice Wing Chun moves against. Added to that, he used electronic devices to push his vision and hearing to their natural limits, while he would calculate the cube roots of various numerical formulas to hone his concentration skills. At the end of this fast-paced hour and a half, he always sweated profusely, gulping in air, yet found himself fulfilled and ready, for he knew he would need all his skills as sharp as possible for what lay ahead. Camera 2 cut to Lincoln Link Allard of the Hidalgo Foundation, who was in studio at CNN along with two more of the four panelists discussing the morning tweet by President Trump. In this one, he essentially repeated the fanciful notion advanced on a conspiracy site that the FDA, in collusion with Big Pharma, was suppressing the news that there was a cancer cure, that such a cure was available for some 10 years now, and, as per usual, no evidence was offered. The normally taciturn Allard gestured vociferously. Isn't it bad enough the leader of the most industrious nation on Earth hasn't anything better to do than repeat these wild lies, this poppycock that is forever being promulgated among the nutbags and disaffected? Worse, he encourages too many of the citizenry to believe such notions rather than actually adhere to fact. He and his cohorts can swallow their own Kool-Aid outlandishness, but science is science. The view on television screens across the nation switched, and camera one was a pulled-back shot of the three sitting at the rotunda with the bearded moderator. Margot Mayfair, who was sitting next to Allard, spoke, "Oh, Link, when will you get off of that? The president knows exactly what he's doing. In this way, he gets the people talking about a matter that in some way will touch all of us. He is a strategic thinker and is exciting folks to put pressure on the drug companies to stop being so greedy and do their ethical duty to accelerate the research they've slow-walked all these years." Mayfair was a registered libertarian, the biracial daughter of old-line civil rights movement icons. This bona fides grated on her parents' lefty friends but made the K Street political consultant a much sought-after twofer pundit darling among the right-of-center set. Allard shook his head. "It's laughable how you Trumpsters contort yourselves like a Cirque du Soleil performer to lend credence to a man who is simply and clearly unfit for the office." That got a heated response from the beamed-in guest, his upper body displayed on a large monitor. What Margot says was on the mark. You liberals just can't get over your envy how this president connects with the common Jane and Joe. "What I can't get over," the fourth guest, Helen Ruiz, a political science professor and columnist for The Nation, said, "is how long there will be support for Trump given his string of broken campaign promises. If you want to talk about what's really troublesome, what about these attacks by the likes of so-called Latino activists calling for assassination?" "What are you talking about?" Allard demanded. Mayfair said, "There's been a lot of activity lately on what's called brown Twitter about your precious Joaquin Norcross being a Trojan horse, that he is nothing but a tool of Whitey and should be dealt with accordingly." That elicited groans from Ruiz and Allard. "I've seen some of those," Allard, who was black, answered. "As has been exposed in the past, a lot of that's malicious activity by white supremacists, or, as you prefer to euphemistically call them, the alt-right, pretending to be black or brown." Now it was the two others' turn to groan and guffaw. Then the director cut to a commercial about a new miracle room duster. "Thank you," tech guru Artemis Stockbridge said to the waiter who'd brought him his bourbon on a shiny silver tray. "My pleasure," the waiter, a stoop-shouldered, balding black man, in his 60s replied as the tech billionaire plucked the squat tumbler away in his long, tapered fingers. Stockbridge turned away and sipped his drink as the waiter slipped off to attend to another guest at the soiree. The gathering was in a brownstone in the Adams Morgan neighborhood of Washington, D.C. The occasion was an informal yet nonetheless A-list heavy informational fundraiser for a school voucher initiative aimed at the ballot in California backed by the Secretary of Education, who was working overtime to hobble and eventually dismantle the public education sector. Stockbridge was a tall man with coiffed, longish blonde hair streaked white and a trim goatee. He moved with a reassured casualness like the aging surfer bum image he cultivated. "Good to see you, Margot," he said, kissing the cheek of the bronze-skinned, brown-haired woman with piercing gray eyes. "Don't think this would be your sort of thing, Artie." Margot Mayfair sampled some of her white wine. "Whatever we can do to raise the educational outcomes of our youth, particularly the disadvantaged ones, I'm willing to investigate." "Even at the expense of choking the life out of the Department of Education?" Her eyes gleamed at him as she had more wine, the emotion in them uncertain. "Blue California is a ripe target for the forces of this administration." "Yes, I know. They're practically salivating at the possibility of pitting millennial hipsters who have made child-rearing an artisanal undertaking against the poor and working-class folks, many black and brown, who are also frustrated by the far too bureaucratic, feather-bedded public school system." She chuckled. "Now that's a tree-hugging billionaire I know." He grunted and smiled. A white-haired man came over and addressed Mayfair. "I hope you make it to the Cape this weekend. Wouldn't miss it, Marty." Soon their host, a friend of the secretary from their college days, had tapped her glass to get everyone's attention. She gave a short pitch to get the checkbooks open, and toward the end of her spiel, after he'd handed his donation over, Stockbridge headed toward the first floor restroom that was past the well-appointed kitchen with its confectioner's oven and overhead pots and pans. In the breakfast room next to the kitchen, the caterer's crew was preparing a last round of hors d'oeuvres. One of the young women, who was assembling stuffed mushrooms, had her earbuds in, bopping her head to YG and Nipsey Hussle's FDT. Moments later, exiting the bathroom, Stockbridge didn't return to the main room where people were still conversing, but went to a side door along the short hallway that led out into the garden area. A heady fragrance of transplanted jacaranda greeted him. There stood the balding waiter, an unlit cigarette in his hand, as if he too had stepped out for a smoke break. It was a starry evening, and the two were shadowy in the warm light of discreet ground-level lighting. Without preamble, the Silicon Valley insider and founder of the Hidalgo Foundation began talking to the other man, who, in this guise, was simply called Claude. 2 days ago, there was an accident involving one of my subsidiaries, Globestar. He explained the driverless truck test, the family van having blown a tire, and the human driver having to make a quick decision given the circumstances. The Lincoln the driver plowed into is leased to a company I know to be one of the many cutouts of Norman Bethune. "You have my attention," the supposed waiter said. He dropped the voice he was using, pretending to be an older man, and reverted to his natural baritone. Bethune, nor the man he was with, hung around, nor has there been any insurance claim made over the smashed-up car. Claude hunched a shoulder. So it was some sort of meeting he doesn't want attention over. But that could be any one of an assortment of wild-ass conspiracies up his butt he's getting the true believers worked up over. Like that time he was going around saying that Obama had planted secret nanny cams in the Oval Office to gather impeachable evidence against Trump. Which would have had its merits, Stockbridge said, blank-faced. But speaking of nanny cams, for the purposes of covering our asses, the truck was equipped with such in case of an accident like what happened. Here's a little something captured at the incident. He took out his smartphone and tapped the screen several times to bring up the footage he wanted. He handed the device to the waiter. One of the cameras was doing an automatic scan and captured Bethune in the Lexus with Dirk Thane, the supposed waiter said. He stopped the video and replayed it. I guess they weren't making plans for a Bertha reunion march on Washington. They could be, the billionaire deadpanned. His friend manifested a death's head grin. Chantel, it's Jerry. The man who stepped inside the compact mobile home was in jeans, a jean jacket over a button-down shirt, and a baseball cap. He carried a fifth of gin in a paper bag, his eyes adjusting to the gloom. She had to step out, said another man in the room. He sat in the dilapidated Barco lounger. Oh, hey, man, baseball cap said. My bad. I didn't know she had company. He turned toward the door, but this was a ruse. He dropped the plastic bottle of gin as a distraction to then use his opposite hand to unlimber the handgun he had in a holster on his belt under his jacket. He wheeled back around and was surprised the second man was standing there in front of him. He hadn't heard a rustle of clothing or his footfalls across the thin carpet. His face was a mass of scarring from fire. Who the hell are you? Baseball cap Jerry began, bringing the gun up to show he was a serious individual. The other man was of a serious mindset as well. His hand flashed out and Jerry backed up, grabbing at his throat, letting the gun drop to the floor. The burned-faced man had jabbed him with stiffened fingers in a spot right beside his Adam's apple. Jerry struggled to breathe. His gun, a semi-auto Browning, was now grasped by the other man, which he used to crack him against the skull. Ugh, he grunted, sinking to a knee, starburst exploding behind his eyes. If you ever want to see your brown sugar honey again, you will tell me what I want to know. If you hurt her, you black bastard, you and your illegitimate children will be skinned and gassed. The burned-faced man chuckled and, grabbing his quarry by the lapels, plucked him from the floor and threw him into the chair he'd been sitting in. You talk tough for a guy who taps on a keyboard all damn day. Jerry, in the baseball cap, glared at the other man, blinking. The disfigured man knew a lot about Jerry Ballas. He was a senior editor and worked for a fake news website that was part, albeit through several front companies, of Norman Bethune's empire. But Ballas had a secret desire, some might argue fetish, for dark-skinned black women. His current thing was Chantel Wardlow, who worked part-time at the local big-box store. Ballas had told her he worked for a restaurant supply chain. I can make noise about blowing your thing with Chantel to your masters, the burn-faced man said. I suppose that would certainly embarrass you and make for some sideways glances, but who knows what you've said to this sister during pillow talk. You don't scare me. I should. This place is wired, Jer, he lied. Ballas's eyes went wide. And more than that, speaking of kids out of wedlock, what about those two cute rugrats you have with what's-her-name in Pittsburgh? Who you send money to on the regular? How do you know this? Is this some kind of test Norman set up? Well, I'm loyal. It's not going to be hard to spin the story that here you are, part of the chosen, yet cavorting around with loose Negro women. It wouldn't be hard to paint the picture that they were actually undercover agents of a counter-espionage cadre Obama set up since leaving office. That's insane. No one would believe that. But his right cheek twitched. The other man stood before him, arms crossed, holding the handgun. Yeah, really? The Clintons sabotaged JFK Jr.'s airplane. John Podesta is a Satanist. 2 or maybe it's 3 million undocumented voted in the past presidential election. Those followers of yours have swallowed a lot of poisonous pablum you've spoon-fed them. How long would they think you're still a true believer? Huh, Jer? What would happen to you then? He didn't need to elaborate. Ballas knew the ferocity the ardent capable of unleashing, particularly on one they thought a turncoat, which ironically was what Ballas was part of concocting against a public figure. Silence ticked by, then, what do you want? This time the burn-faced man didn't break into a smile like he had when he was clawed. One of the guards was in a modified camo and wore a watch cap with a logo on it. He was a member of a group called Blood of the Lamb Consecrated, so-called Christian gun enthusiasts dedicated to making America great again. He held his M4 assault rifle at rest but ready, diagonal across his chest, hand on the grip, finger extended over the trigger guard. A faint noise caused him to pivot. 2 prongs of a modified taser shot out of the dark, piercing his bullet-resistant vest and into his chest. The prongs were designed to penetrate as they were longer than usual and had screw-like tips that rotated, drawing current from the taser. Voltage coursed through the wires the prongs were attached to, and the guard gritted his teeth and reared back, but he didn't go down. Take more than that, you motherless defiler, he wheezed at the masked man who stepped into view. Before he could bring the M4's barrel up, a suppressor on its end, 2 throwing stars blurred through the air at their target. 1 sank into the guard's hand, and the other snicked a wound alongside his neck as it twirled away. For the love of our savior, he declared, his finger reflexively jerking the trigger, spewing rounds into the earth. The proletarian adventurer swiftly covered the distance between them. The blow of his heel to the guard's knee buckled him, then he drove the sole of that same heavy boot into the man's face. Simultaneously, he wrestled the rifle away from now lax hands and used the butt to viciously render the other one unconscious. The intruder was dressed in black jeans, heavy black boots, and a dark zipped-up windbreaker and a cowl-like mask. Like the unconscious guard's vest, the intruder's clothes were bullet-resistant, woven with Kevlar and a polyethylene blend. Various gadgets and tools were secreted about his person as well. Around the corner of the 2-story cinder block building, the second entry lay on the ground, felled by the masked man's stiff-fingered strike to his carotid artery. The cinder block structure was supposedly the regional offices of the restaurant supply business that Ballas worked for, Industrial Kitchen Fixtures. At a metal side door, the vigilante produced what looked like a smartphone. Holding the device, he connected a wire leading from this to the electronic lock on the door. The screen of the phone-like gadget swam with numbers across its face as it hacked the lock for the correct passcode. Soon there was a satisfying click, but the masked vigilante paused, paying attention to a disturbance of his chi. He turned his body away from the dark opening just as bullets raked the spot where he'd been standing. 2 members of the BLC rushed out of the building, firing their weapons. The masked man had sought cover behind a black SUV, and he calmly cut those 2 down by shooting them in the shins. They were still alive and deadly, and he rolled a mini flashbang grenade between them. It went off with a boom of heat and light. Damn it, the heathen has blinded me, one of them said, lying on his side on the ground. As his vision started to return to normal, he was knocked unconscious by 3 strategically placed blows of the attacker's fist to pressure points on his upper body. The other wounded man was already out, bleeding from his mouth and nose. M4 in hand, the invader eschewed the front door the other 2 had exited. His lenses cycled from being dark like sunglasses, having altered when the flashbang went off, back to their normal green hue. He reached another metal door. in the rear of the building with a keyed lock, but not an electronic one. He bent and put his ear to its surface, listening for movement on the other side. Hearing none, he straightened up and extracted a small battery-powered diamond-tipped drill to get him past the door's double lock. Before he could get to work, the door exploded outward, sending him and it flying in the opposite direction. He landed hard on his back. Fortunately, the door was somewhere else instead of on top of him. His flexible armor had kept him alive, but he estimated the three who came out of the building didn't know that. A beam from a light mounted on an assault rifle cut through the smoke of the explosion, seeking his form. "Where is that son of Ham?" a voice demanded. "That ghetto-bred meddler's no damn ghost. He has to be here." Two metal golf ball-sized spheres rolled into view, emitting green smoke. The three started coughing, their eyes watering. "Some kind of tear gas," one declared, running away, trying to clear his throat. An emerald pall hung about them as they sought to fan away the vapors. "Wait, what?" another gasped, a sudden weakness spreading through his limbs. "It's knockout." He didn't finish as he collapsed to the ground, unconscious. The second consecrated member was far enough out of the fumes that the inside of his head felt fuzzy, but he was still upright. He spun in a half circle, shooting into the mist as he figured it was from there that the masked man would attack. "Die, you cut-rate, commie, tofu-eating blackguard," he shouted over the rounds churning from his weapon. The firing stopped, a string of gray smoke drifting from his hot barrel. He turned. Before him, a column of the velvety smoke seemed to be congealing around something solid in its opaque center. "Got you, Pimpernel," he avowed, the assault rifle rattling its high-velocity bullets again. The smoke separated, but there was nothing within. "By Adam," he avowed. "From me to you," a gruff voice said in his ear. The disguised man sank his butterfly knife in the other man's side, and he gasped. A chop of his neck subdued him for the time being. Even as the wounded man dropped to the ground, the intruder was in motion. Now unfettered, the masked vigilante stepped into the facility's black interior. Calmly, he put away his apparatus while tuning his senses outward for other presences. Detecting no one else, at least in his immediate vicinity, he then moved along rows of restaurant supplies from mobile pan racks, refrigerator compressors, to meat slicers. Though it was dark in here, aided by his goggles coated with a kind of night vision substance, and his practiced light tread, the intruder moved easily about, not disturbing any of the equipment. His goal was not pilfering a state-of-the-art countertop confectioner's oven, but gaining entry to what lay beneath the supply house. So far, he hoped, no alarms had been raised. But he knew better than to be complacent. The Black Pimpernel reached what seemed like the door to the basement. He paused, his hand suspended above the latch. From overhead, there was a whoosh of air as a trap door in the ceiling banged open, and dropping onto him were two massive anacondas. Worse, he could see the beasts had been genetically altered, proof of a rumor the Pimpernel had surfaced through dark web chatter. The Zelnox Corporation was a global agricultural enterprise that ran massive feedlots, manufactured pesticides, and owned the patents on numerous genetically modified seeds. The word was that Zelnox, at the behest of the current administration, had branched out into other sorts of research beyond vegetables, fruits, and livestock. Not surprisingly, the president owned stock in Zelnox. The mutated anacondas were thicker and more muscular than ones the masked man had encountered before. And like the long-gone Stegosaurus, each had a ridge of small, hard, pointy ridges lining their spines. One of the prehistoric-sized snakes fell past onto the floor near his feet. The second creature wrapped part of its 30-foot-plus body around the masked man's torso, tightening about his body as it sought to squeeze him to death, then devour him. The lights came on. "Damn it!" he grimaced, his hands latched onto the snake's huge girth. But already the breath was being drained from him, and he heard a crack along his ribcage. The other snake slithered over to him and began coiling about his lower legs. Added to that, he heard footfalls coming up from below through the door in front of him. The BLC guard intended to shoot him to make sure he no longer was a threat. Blocking the numbing pain, causing black spots to explode behind his eyes, he extracted a large silver capsule from a hidden pocket up toward his shoulder blade. The snake on his upper body reared its mammoth wedge-shaped head back, and now its mouth open and crag-like fangs poised rushed toward him, intending to clamp onto his head. Jamming his forearm under the creature's jaws to temporarily halt the snake's attack, he flicked the capsule into its maw and closed his eyes. Activated by the reptile's inner heat, the capsule released its contents instantaneously. The resulting explosion burst the anaconda apart, spraying the chrome cookware with its ichor. Huge hunks of reptile flesh flew everywhere. The masked man was knocked over, temporarily dazed. The first guard through the doorway was struck in the face by a section of snake, and he was knocked backward down the stairs, colliding with a man below him rushing up. The two tumbled over. "What the damnation is going on?" a voice snarled from below. "Get your clumsy butts up." Both hands on the second snake's throat, the dark intruder was back on his feet and charging forward, pulling the writhing anaconda with him. "Figured I'd bring the party to you, self-righteous bastards," he blared, leaping and descending on the regrouping guards, ascending again. A burst from an N4 seared close, but not into his form, as the gunman couldn't get a clear shot, given the intruder was now entangled with the other men. Like bowling pins, they fell back or off the sides of the stairs, taking out a flimsy wooden railing in the process. They all wound up on the concrete floor below, each scrambling to get to their feet, except one of them who'd landed on the side of his head with a thud and remained still. "Got you, you slick son of a bitch," one of the guards declared, about to fire on the Pimpernel. But he was still wrangling the snake. He girded his teeth as he whipped the heavy mutant around. The enraged reptile sank its fangs into the other man's arm, biting it clean off. As he cried out in terror, the snake got its body around him and went to work grinding his insides to mush while wrapping its tail around another guard's lower legs. A five-pointed throwing star sailed across the room and penetrated the side of the neck of another guard, severing a vital artery. Crimson sprayed from him as he fell to the ground dead. Two other Blood of the Lambs consecrated were left, but the intruder became a blur, delivering a combination of Jeet Kune Do strikes and old-fashioned fisticuffs blows. The two keeled over like cardboard cutouts onto the floor of the hidden computer center. It was from here, the invader knew, that the trolls and bots in service of the president and his minions generated the propaganda meant to pump up false stories and alt facts, thus to mislead and misdirect, while the real business of dismantling democracy went on. That the supposed tweets from POTUS, the more off-the-wall and seemingly unhinged, often came from the center, dictated by the likes of the Director of External Communication. He reflected on the Ministry of Truth's slogan in 1984, "Ignorance is strength," as around him various writers, editors, and techs, male and female, either ran away or cowered near their cubicles. Fists raised above his head, the Avenger of Justice yelled, "You've got a minute to get your asses out of here before I bring this place down around your ears." As they knew this man was ruthless, he was, after all, labeled the most dangerous Negro in America by right-wing talk radio show hosts and various alt-white sites. As one, the crew dashed for the stairs and the exits. Now, if any of you are feeling frisky, thinking like you want to get your star on the wall in the Reagan Library or some such, he yelled, "Try me." He was hefting one of the assault rifles, positioned in a way that he could cut down anyone coming at him. None of them took him up on his dare as they departed. Free to explore and gather intel, the masked man used his electronic devices to access several data banks, gleaning useful information he stored away. Sitting at a console, watching a particular file download that contained financial records of the president's secret holdings in Russia, the back of his neck tingled. He swung around in the chair, snatching up the M4 he'd set close by as the wall near him exploded outward. Chunks of cinder block shot through the room like cannon fire, knocking over computers and pulverizing into other walls. The freedom fighter's finely tuned reflexes had kicked in, and in midair, he twirled his body so as to avoid two sections of cinder block. Still, he was struck a glancing blow that ruptured his protective gear. "I'm going to stuff and mount your head on my wall, Pimpernel," declared the attacker. The masked man regarded the new enemy before him. The man was encased in an exoskeleton suit that had been modified by the military from its original industrial use on oil platforms in deep water. The master of disguise knew this from tech manuals he read for relaxation. He shot at the armored man with the assault rifle to no avail. Not that he figured his bullets would prevail, but he'd been curious. He was going to get a demonstration meant to be his last. The suit was a clanky assemblage of metal struts, servo units, molded sections like sides of freight cars removed and hammered into new shapes by a demigod blacksmith, hydraulic lines, and a dome constructed over his head. In the man-metal construct, he stood more than 10 feet tall. "Are you done?" the suited man taunted when the firing stopped. Gripping a metal desk in a mechanized hand, he threw it at the disguised man. The Pimpernel went prone and slid on his belly as the desk flew mere inches over him, crashing into a conference table, sending the laptops on it flying. A hinged metal fist swung at him, and only because he grabbed a piece of broken wall to absorb the blow, the administration's adversary survived. Still, the impact drove him off his feet and into the wall. He bounced off and fell to the floor. The armored man bounded over, and the Black Pimpernel rolled away as a metal foot came down, cracking the floor instead of splitting his head open. "You can't run forever, Rabbit." Another swing, and the fist missed, embedding itself momentarily in the cinder block. "Ugh," the suited man grunted as his micromotors worked to free his hand. This was the opportunity the dark intruder needed, and utilizing his parkour skills, he first hopped on the listing desk, then from there, first to the wall, then recoiled upward, and completing a somersault, landed on the back of the machine man. "Get the hell off me!" He tried to reach his hand back, but his armor wasn't as flexible as human muscle, and there was only so far the hand could go. "I'll get you," he yelled through the audio jack on his metal suit. Gyros whined as he twisted about to shake the Pimpernel off. He started to kick and otherwise move the desk and other obstructions from his path. The unwelcome rider knew the mechanized man's next move would be to head to a wall and try and scrape him off. Acting urgently but centered, calm in the storm, he had in hand two dull-plated tubes from his cache. The man in the exoskeleton was now at one of the walls and reared back into it, trying to crush the Pimpernel. His heavy body slammed against the cinder blocks, but the masked man leaped free. "Damn it!" the armored man swore, thudding after the other one who bounded about. As the metal man moved forward, grabbing at him, the Pimpernel, jumping up like a b-baller, twisted about in midair and flung a broken piece of tabletop at those mechanized lower legs. His aim was true, and the man in the exoskeleton found himself tripping onto the floor, face first. The Black Pimpernel acted hastily and applied the acid in his glass line containers to a specific hydraulic line, the one that went from the reservoir of the stuff on the back of the suit, then keyed off to a main receptor on each leg. The connection severed, the legs would be unable to move. "No, no," the now impotent attacker bellowed, banging the sides of his fists onto the concrete floor, chunks of concrete being thrown up, dust rising about his form like a felled alloy baby having a tantrum. Back outside, the Black Pimpernel was running. He knew from his reconnoitering there was a private airstrip that serviced the facility. There was also a Gulfstream jet waiting on the tarmac in the dark, and Dirk Thane was a pilot. There was open field between the office building and the airstrip. The masked man, sweat trickling down below his half-mask, paused, crouching down. The grass was tall enough in the field that a guard could easily be lying in it to pop up and gun down the invader. He could see a figure running toward the jet. Thane. Reaching into his jacket, he had only one play to make, and it better work. He ran forward, thumbing a release lever free, then counting, tossed before him a grenade. He held it so that its fuse would burn some, and in that way the grenade erupted in the air in bright reds and yellows. He too had dived into the grass, but the brief pulse of light had revealed the top of the watch cap of the last guard. Knowing his cover was blown, he sprang up, but was too late. Two shots echoed from the masked man's handgun from where he lay on the ground. His explosive shells ignited the assault rifle, which blew up in the other man's hands. He screamed, his hands and face on fire. He rolled around to extinguish the flames. Then he lay still, smoldering and groaning. Thane was taxiing the jet, dropping to a knee, bringing the burn guard's assault rifle up to his shoulder. The man in black shredded the jet's tires with well-aimed rifle fire. Thane was no doubt on a cell phone or radio calling in more troops. He had to act fast. I'll set the plane on fire and gladly roast you alive in it, Snowflake, the Pimpernel called out. He was out of grenades, let alone hadn't brought along any thermite bombs, but he sounded convincing. You have 10 seconds. The hatch opened. Get on the ground, face first. You don't know what you're messing with. This is so out of your league. He shot over Thane's head to hasten compliance. Standing near the prone individual, he could see the metal attaché case just inside the door of the aircraft. If you twitch, I'll kill you, he said, starting for the case. But he stopped, a fragment of information ticking at the edge of memory. He took aim and pumped rounds into the metal case. It was booby-trapped and exploded. He turned back to Thane, who tried not to look worried. Cute. As he'd done previously, he brought the butt of the assault rifle down on the other man's head and knocked him out. He searched his body and found the thumb drive he sought tucked in his sock. He left flying the jet away as two black SUVs sped toward the field, shots flinging from them like runaway meteorites. Did you get a job plowing that road to the private golf course? The crowd, a mixture of races and ages, shouted no and hell no. The rally was across the highway to the Medgate golf course. The president had just been there golfing the past week, a facility he developed in his real estate tycoon phase. But your congressman, in step with this administration's supposed infrastructure recovery, gave the private outfit that tax break to build it. Is that what you voted for? Is that what he promised here in Michigan? Well, is it? There were more no's and cheers. Texas Agricultural Commissioner Joaquin Norcross walked back and forth across the small stage, holding the wireless mic in black leather sport coat, designer jeans, and no tie. On he went, part of his brainstorming Red and Rust Tour, it was called. He used a handkerchief to wipe at the sweat on his face. Despite the admonishment from certain old-school handlers, particularly for a Latino candidate, even one with a white last name, out stumbling for a possible presidential bid, he wasn't shy about using weighted language. You can't call this mess draining the swamp. That's putting us in the swamp. What a pendejo. The crowd gleefully echoed his last sentence. A man who'd been at the side of the crowd was moving behind several others as Norcross finished and was down among the people, shaking hands. The man did not look threatening in any way, middle-aged, heavy features, khaki pants. He looked exactly like the kind of working-class fellow who'd come out to hear the maybe candidate. Better, he too was Latino. From his shirt pocket, he extracted what appeared to be a normal ballpoint pen. He depressed the button and clicked into place the writing nib. One prick on Norcross's skin was all it would take. The symptoms would lay him up like dengue fever. Then he'd get the call that next time it would be a bullet if he didn't quit. His poll numbers were looking too promising. He grinned. The bodyguards didn't even notice him. A foot stuck out, and the humble-looking man stumbled. Instantly, hands were on him, but they weren't there to help him up. A bodyguard was on either side of him, and one of them said in a low voice, "Come with us." "Hey, you can't," he began, but he was the one to get pricked. A quick jab into his arm, and he went limp, disoriented and unable to speak. "No problem. A little too excited is all," said one of the bodyguards to an onlooker. The man was hustled away. Minutes later, Norcross retreated to let a local band come out to finish off. He shook Link Allard's hand. "I might have to hire you full-time as my speechwriter, Link. Of course, I can't match what Artemis pays you. I just give your words a bit of structure. You're the one that says them with conviction." The candidate said, "We're fighting out of the corner, Link. We ain't off the ropes yet, but we will be." "Yes, sir." Orale. He clapped him on the shoulder and walked off. Allard winced, his two cracked ribs bothering him since the side door blew up on him. He'd have to talk to Arnos about enhancing his gear. Maybe micro server units would do the trick. Released this morning is what many left and various mainstream organizations say is the smoking gun connecting this administration to the reported attempts on the health, if not the life, of Joaquin Norcross. Evidence has surfaced that small business owner Efrain Braga, a one-time youthful member of the Contras in Nicaragua during the Reagan years, being used against Norcross. Further, computer records that are still being verified allege that the president's director of external communication, Norman Bethune, was involved, as was ex-military contractor and controversial figure Dick Thane, the latter now having fled to parts unknown. Still to be determined is the involvement of the radical vigilante dubbed the Black Pimpernel. He borrowed that name from the late freedom fighter Nelson Mandela, who's referred to that when he was public enemy number one in apartheid South Africa. Margot Mayfair used the remote to click off the television. His apologizers will have to twist themselves into Gordian knots to make this new round of excuses, Link Allard said. Including me, shit. We all must do our part. Playing the conservative, Mayfair was able to gather intel from the right-wing camp. It was she who told him she'd heard about the attaché case gimmick Thane had used in a tight spot in Afghanistan. She overheard the boast at some cocktail party. Don't you lay that selfless revolutionary shit on me, man. She leaned over and kissed him when their lips and tongues parted. As Joaquin's campaign heats up, how the hell are you going to keep up this crazy life of yours, Link? The Pimpernel, Claude, the Burn Man, Ornette the Janitor, and those other personas you put on. The good thing about all the deportations is the amount of menial work available for a brother these days, Margot. The return of the invisible man. Don't be cute. You know damn well you're burning the candle down quick from both ends. She looked away, wiping at her cheek. God damn it, Link. What happens if you get found out? The rain on the blood of the Lamb's consecrated headquarters had been a misdirection. Though the absconded files the resistance knew would prove valuable. But since Mayfair had been invited to a confab on Cape Cod, she'd been tasked with discovering what Bethune and Thane had been meeting about at that duck blind cafe in the desert. She was able to clone the smartphone of Martin Hallsworth, her host and confidant of Bethune. The leads gleaned from this phone led them to uncovering the plot against Norcross. Maybe it's time for a few more Pimpernels. For sure, some women. Mayfair raised an eyebrow. Yeah, I know. It's worse than heroin or booze. Sex, even. You tell yourself you're doing good. Being righteous for the cause. You are, but God help you. When you slip on that mask and put it on the line, it's one crazy-ass rush. I'll tell you what else is a rush. She pulled him to her, and they made love again. Later, Mayfair's double-encrypted phone buzzed, and lifting her head off of Allard's chest, she retrieved it from the nightstand, noting the name that was on the screen, Druk Burbank. She grinned at the cover name and answered the call. Margot, drawled the familiar voice on the other end. Damn fine op you two pulled off. Thank you, she said. Looks like I just gleaned some new information from one of my taps on Trump. Significant and pertinent, I'd say, he added in his clipped manner. The two discussed this some. Link, she said in a loud whisper when they'd paused, waking her paramour and comrade in arms. His eyelids fluttered. It's Big O. He wants us to come over tomorrow for a game of eight ball and a chat. She brightened. Give me a chance to try out a new disguise. And a chance for me to win back the 100 he took off me last time, huh? Double or nothing, he says. Link Allard squinted at her with one eye. The following day, while being filled in on the latest intel gleaned from one of the various ways the current commander-in-chief was being surveilled surreptitiously, the former occupant of the office cleaned Allard's clock at the pool table yet again. That was Thus Strikes the Black Pimpernel by yours truly, Gary Phillips. And again, you'll find that story in The Obama Inheritance, 15 Stories of Conspiracy Noir. There are stories in there from the likes of Walter Mosley, sci-fi grandmaster Robert Silverberg, and Derringer Award-winning author Travis Richardson. You won't find a clunker in the bunch, and I think you'll enjoy the anthology. Thanks for your time.